Marilyn Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Life Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2, for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 23, delivered on November 12th.
Today, capital budgeting. Before we get into it, just a brief look at the markets, just to make sure we have everything. Sir, tell me, how are the markets doing?
It is a great day on the market.
No, it's not. It's a moderately good day. Moderately.
Why?
Because you don't have only the NASDAQ really surging, but the other ones are up. Don't get me wrong. A great day is 1%, 2%. This is a day where your retirement portfolio won't suck for the day, but it's still going to mean that you eat cat food at the end. So honestly, though, it's a pretty good day. One of the things about it is it's a broad-based rally. All of the markets are up. However, you'll notice from the SPARK chart, an interesting thing is going on. Going through the morning in this one, taking the S&P 500, for example, as I usually do. What do you see as the, ma'am, what do you see happening in the morning trading?
It went down.
Huh? What happened at the opening bell? What was going on? Walk me through. At the opening bell, who was in charge? Go on. The bulls were in charge, yes. They were pushing the market up. That was a pretty steep climb. You see that? And you notice that there was a bull spike there. Do you see that bull spike at about in the earlier morning? But then it kind of topped out. And since then, there was an attempt at a rally again, but it has eased back. So in other words, there seemed to have been some good news in the market early on that propelled the market. But then after that, the market just lost its momentum and it's kind of sagged back down. Most likely, this would be the result of, I don't know, there's a lot of factors that could be involved in it, but there's no big thing that's yelling at the markets right now. We're still sitting on the edge of our seats wondering if there's going to be any kind of a trade deal with China. But it's really hard to call what's going on right now. As you can see, though, moving over here and having a look at the gold, of course, gold eased back in such a bull rally. Gold's not going to be big play. Neither is silver in this today. But as you can see, also, the 10-year bonds sank. So money moved out of the bond market and the gold market and back into stocks. That's a good sign that the market is having a very positive outlook. But of course, as bond prices sag, as you see there, the 10-year is doing there, that means that yields are beginning to go back up. So it's hard for us to say if that's good news or bad news. If we see yields going up, that means that interest rates going up is going to suppress business activity. Now, you're going to see a lot of that today. Why interest rates propel business activity. So when you see interest rates going down, you say, yay, that's jobs, that's all that kind of stuff. But when you see yields going back up, that means interest rates are going up, and that means that there's going to be a suppression of business activity. Today's market is saying, yes, equities are going up, but at the expense of higher interest rates. So ultimately, it's kind of a mixed bag. On the surface, it looks great, but when you look at this, you seem to see that there is some difficulty. Now, as you can see that even in the bond market, there was a price spike, but then a real heavy drop-off, and then a series of price spikes, and then a steep drop-off again. So we're seeing actually a lot of volatility in the bond market today. In other words, investors are kind of going back and forth on what's going to happen in the next few weeks or months. Now, this is going to be one of those, here's a calculator. And this calculator is going to make this today's work a lot easier than it would be otherwise. And on Thursday, I will show you how to do this in Excel. I had planned to do it a couple weeks ago, but I thought, no, let's hit the subject right on the head. As I had mentioned before, though, the calculator actually has once you get used to it, has a more logical way of calculating these answers for these problems than Excel does. Excel's way of doing it is okay, but this kind of focuses more on what we're really deciding and what the factors are that we're using for the decision. Capital budgeting. In some ways, capital budgeting is like valuing stocks. We're looking at the present value of future expected cash flows. There is a big difference, though, in terms of what's driving the cash flows. In a stock market, you invest. Let's try this. Madam, have you ever invested in stocks yet?
Okay.
Loser. No, okay. That's okay. You're smarter than most. Sir, have you invested in stocks before? Okay. I'm trying to find someone who looks... You've invested in stocks. Okay. Do you call the companies and say, hi, I want the stock price to go up? ASAP, chop, chop, let's get it done. You've never done that. You've never gone into the company and let's rearrange things here because I think that this company can make more profit if we do it my way. No, that's probably the quickest way out the top floor of the building via the glass window. You can't decide. You can't make the kinds of changes that could improve the prospects of the stock. You're just sitting there, a pretty face in the crowd of many investors, sometimes millions of investors, just hoping for the best. It's a gamble. Now, when you do capital budgeting, which is where you're deciding whether projects are a yes or a no, this is a place where in a company you do have control over at least some of the factors involved. The planning stage is where you get everything right. And then the operations stage is where you make sure that everything is right and you make modifications on the fly if there are problems. So in capital budgeting, we do have some control. There are things we don't have control over, of course, even in a company. The interest rate environment's going to kick us in the butt, possibly. Unforeseen problems in production will catch us off guard. Our competitors might very well catch us off guard. But at least we have some degree of control over the future expected cash flows that we don't have with a corporation at all. With that in mind, capital budgeting is one of the core things that is done in finance. Now, as I told you early in the semester, there are different careers in finance. Investments, a lot of people think, well, finance, that's about stocks and bonds and investing. Well, that's actually only one aspect. It's not a very perspective for if you're looking for a job. And another one is corporate finance. Corporate finance is the internal finance in a corporation where we make decisions on projects. We make decisions about how to finance projects, all that kind of stuff. There are more jobs in corporate finance by far than there are in investments. And there's a good bonus, too. Here's something that's interesting about finance. Madam, in corporate finance, we get to make marketing people cry. Because we are the ones who say no to their projects if they don't meet our criteria. Now, unfortunately, marketing people can be quite savvy. They can figure out exactly what we're looking for and then reshape numbers. And unfortunately, that's because they've taken a finance course and they know how we do the decision making. So, in other words, if the future expected cash flows, when you take their present value, they're less than the initial investment, well, they can rearrange things to work for them. Give you an example. I think I already told you this example. Many years ago, at another university here in town, and I won't mention its name, I had this, they had this weird way of doing classes for you juniors like you. They had this integrated course that had a marketing, a finance, an accounting, and I think an operations. And the students would rotate among the classes day to day, and we integrated it so that it was sort of like a comprehensive business platform for all students in business. It was tried at other universities, and usually they give up on it after a few years. But on this particular occasion, during this, they told us that the mayor at that time of Bloomington was going to make a guest speech in the evening at the university. And we were to bring all the students to listen to the mayor of Bloomington describe her vision, her legacy. It was going to be an arena, a place where they would have sports, musical entertainment, other kinds of events. It was going to be a big, great venue. So the mayor came to this speech, and of course all of the students at that private preppy school came looking really nice, perfect in every way, dressed for success, looking like the best kids you would ever want to know. Of course, that was just for that time. Then they went back to blowing weed and all of that. But they looked perfect there, and they sat there very patiently as the mayor came up, gave her speech, and then she brought the finance guy from the city to show the mathematics, how great this was on paper, the future expected cash flows against the costs of it. And he was obviously not the kind of guy who was a public speaker, and she brought him in on a nice leash and set him down there and said, "Tell him all about it." And so he did. And he laid out, first of all, the costs of it, how this arena, what it was going to cost, this huge arena in downtown Bloomington. And then he went on to talk about the future expected cash flows of it. Now, clearly, he was influenced by marketing. The first thing was that he talked about was the revenue stream of this project. This is going to service. People are going to buy tickets from a 60-mile radius around Bloomington. Excuse me, around Bloomington. Of course, that would mean that it was directly competing against the Peoria Civic Center. And if you had a choice of going to the Peoria Civic Center or to the Bloomington place, you'd probably choose the Peoria Center. The other thing was that much of this 60-mile radius is farm country, and farmers generally tend not to go to wild and fun events. They are farmers. They work their asses off. They're tired at the end of the day, and they sure as hell don't want to watch something drive to Bloomington. So the revenues were projected way too optimistically. That's the first thing you look for. Overbelief in your revenue generation ability. Generally speaking, and I do this much more intensely in the next course, generally speaking, and I saw this when I was a consultant. I'd go in and I'd talk to these, my first meeting with them. Okay, tell me about your product. Tell me what you're doing here. Teach me. And they would almost uniformly say, this is going to come out of the gate and sell like hotcakes. That revenues are just going to go straight up like that. Well, no, they're not. No. Almost optimistically, the first thing is you're going to struggle right out of the gates with product awareness. You're going to barely sell the product for 1, 2, 3 years. And then if you survive long enough, and that's where your planning comes in. You've got to make sure that you have enough invested dollars that you can survive a couple of lean years at least. And then eventually you're going to get a little bit of product awareness, and you might get a little bit of brand loyalty and all that good stuff. And if you are lucky, you will begin to get into more stores, into more shops, and you'll be able to get some more awareness. You'll be able to afford hard marketing, and you'll begin to have at least a modest rise. And unfortunately, here's where the next absolute bitch comes in. That's when you find out, oh, we're successful, and this is a free market. This is capitalism. So you're going to have competitors notice you're suddenly making a profit, and they're going to start coming in, and they're going to start beating on your gates with their versions of your product. And that's going to clip off your growth rate unless you really market the hell out of your product and fight them off as hard as you can. So that idea that you're going to have this giant spike at the beginning and it's going to just stay there ain't going to happen. It just isn't, notwithstanding all of the stories you've heard about instant successes in business. Anyway, so the revenues were overestimated. And then the costs were in a very problematic situation because the financial analysis did not include the cost of the land, okay? Why don't you have the cost of the land, I asked the guy, because my students, of course, weren't going to ask questions. He said, well, we own the land, which is, of course, the wrong answer, because whether you own it or you are going to buy it, it's still a cost. That's called opportunity cost if it already is in your possession. If you are going to use something for a project, it doesn't matter if you own it. It's an opportunity cost. In other words, the cost of the best foregone alternative. They could have sold that land instead of using it for this project. In other words, it is a cost of the project. And it's a significant cost year over year. The longer they hold that land and have that building on it, that Coliseum, the longer it's a cost. It's a bleed on their cash flows of the city itself. There were other issues too. They were assuming that they would be able to hand off a lot of costs. For example, the cost of congestion in the city during an event, the cost of additional police on the Bloomington police force, the cost of this, that, and the other thing. They just didn't put those in there. Of course, the whole idea was to make it so that the project was a go. And, of course, anything I said, I got myself in a lot of trouble giving the mayor a hard time by not just sitting there like a wallflower. But anyway, of course, now we have this Bloomington Arena. It is a money loser to the tune of millions of dollars every year. It has been riddled with corruption. It has been riddled with low attendance at venues and the few venues they have there. It is a disaster. And of course, that's all what was intended by the people who were behind the scenes, the promoters out of Chicago, LA, New York. They go from city to city. They even provide the cash flow analysis for the city financial people. And then, of course, they know that it will fail, and they'll just be sitting there on the side, minding their, biding their time, until they can buy that arena at pennies on the dollar. They've done it in city after city after city in the United States. They've even pulled the stunt a few times in Europe. There you go. That's why we have to be hard asses in the finance world. When the corporate finance, we say no, that means no. And if those numbers don't look right to us, we might very well go back and fix those numbers before we actually even run our analysis. And then, of course, we have one more tool that we use, too. But I'll go into that in a minute here. Anyway, there's a cautionary tale. And don't get me wrong. It's not just amateur or small-time analysts that make the mistakes. There are spectacular examples of companies that overestimated revenues, way overestimated them. And then they, of course, got their butts kicked and they ended up having something, an embarrassment where they had to shut down a project and walk away from it. And they took a beating on it. And of course, sometimes a few people got fired or demoted in the process. Coca-Cola is an example. there was a product, it actually tasted better than Coke. Coca-Cola, they called it New Coke. Their revenue estimates seemed reasonable. It was going to be a hit. It was Coke. And it died very, very badly, very, very quickly. New Coke. Why? Well, it tasted better. It was a good drink. People just didn't want new in Coke. They wanted their Coke. You give them blind taste tests, they would taste the new Coke and they say, oh, this is great. But when you would show them the label, new Coke, they say, oh, I don't want that. See, that's an overestimate of revenues based upon a lack of understanding of psychological factors that go into buying decisions. Great, great disaster. A Japanese company, I think I already mentioned this one. A Japanese company many years ago penetrating the American market in the 1970s and 80s. It wanted to create a very small, fuel-efficient, compact metro car. And it wanted to do it and target, they were the marketers in Japan, said, let's target this to the modern American woman. So their marketing was to the strong, independent, self-assured, self-motivated business woman of the 1980s. And what did they call it? The cutie. Yeah, that worked. It was a disaster. Another one that died on the vine. So many plans, so many disasters have come along the way. And actually, eventually, we may see that with these vegetable burgers, too. They have a flash in the pan. The price of the stocks are going through the roof, even though the companies are bleeding money out the bottom line. Eventually, those products may become one of those case studies in why it spiked at first and then died. Anyway, getting to the subject here. First things first. Incremental cash flows. When we look at a new project, in a corporation, and most of you will be in a corporation, quite possibly a pretty large one or a very large one. The corporation has many different operations, different divisions, different hierarchies going up to the CFO, COO, and CEO, and CIO. But when you look at a new project, the first thing we do is say, look at that project in isolation from the rest of the company. Pretend that this is a company of its own. Its cash flows are coming from it, not from anything else. If we have to use something from another division for this project, we will consider that a cost, even if it isn't a real cost. In other words, we have to take opportunity costs very seriously. In other words, what is the extra? Incremental here means extra or additional cash flow that this project contributes to the company. Now, it gets a little bit hairy down there at the end because of every year, because this will probably produce a depreciation shield that would be shared by the whole company. So in other words, if the cost of this project, if the cost of this project, let's say, is $15,000, and I'm going to do this real simplistically, and we depreciate that over 5 years, that would mean that there's $3,000 deducted from the profit and loss statement every year. Well, what that does is protect the entire company's revenue from $3,000 of pre-tax. So if you took a rate of 21%, you would have 6,000
$300. No, $630. That would not be paid in taxes by the whole company. So in other words, there is a protection of some money there. The whole company benefits from that depreciation shield. So we have to recognize that as sort of a positive cash flow. I'll get into that next week, actually a little bit on Thursday. But do recognize that we are looking at the project in isolation. However, there are factors that are going to affect the rest of the company, both negative and positive. Now that's one of the positives, and I'll get into a couple of other positives that are pretty soft here in a minute. But the one thing about this, how this project can affect the rest of the company. On the negative side, and this is a big negative sign, is the continuing worry about cannibalism. Are we producing a project? Are we producing a product that is going to cannibalize other products that we already have? Is it going to take away from sales of something else we make? If that's going to happen, that is a negative in the revenue of this project. Its incremental cash flow is taken down by the extent to which it cannibalizes other products in the company's line. Companies spend a lot of, they concern themselves quite a bit with this. When they launch a new product, the one thing they want to make sure is that the consumers are understand that this isn't a replacement for something else we have. Or they make sure that their demographic target on this product is different from the demographic target on another product that they have. In other words, they sectorize their market as much as they can. So, for example, you might make a shampoo. It's a nice shampoo for everybody's hair. But now we want to make another shampoo. Okay, this shampoo is going to be for a specific kind of person. Maybe an upscale buyer who would not consider our lower-end product. Or maybe for a real low-level person who would not be able to afford our better product. You don't want this product that we're going to come online to take sales away from the product that we already have. And for example, in a case like yours, I'd say normal to oily hair. Yeah, I'd say that. So certainly we already have one for that, normal to oily. However, we're now going to recognize that your demographic has moved. You've gotten older. So what are we going to do for the man with thinning hair or the man with gray in his hair? Do you really want to look gray? That's an old man. Remember Stranger Danger? We don't want you to look like an old man because kids run away from you. You see, we will move with you. In some cases, we walk our demographic upward, and then we create another post down here for the new demographic coming in. That has become a very popular thing. For example, car companies, they will actually make the same car better and more upscale through time to track a demographic of someone like you when you were 18. This was a car that was cheapo, good on gas, and all of that. As you aged, we made that same model of car look better and better, and then we brought in a car down here that would satisfy the new 18-year-olds. We track and post on our demographics. I don't know if you've heard about that in marketing yet, but there are a lot of products that are like that too. Others don't pay much attention to that, but anyway. We want to avoid cannibalism. Now, on the upside, and this is a real soft one, synergism. Can this product actually help sales of another product we have? Could we make these so that they boost? This one is actually benefiting another product that we've got online.
to make it more attractive to our consumers, to our fans, to our brand loyalists. That's something, it's speculative at best that you can do this, but it has been successful in some venues. So for example, you will have tea companies, companies that make specialty teas, come out with special teapots and tea boxes to provide for your special teas. Things like that are not that unusual. We also, in some cases, stories are all around about, for one thing, is the shoe phenomenon. We always used to produce lots and lots of different shoes, different varieties, different colors, different brands in the same company, and we targeted the female market. It occurred to us about 10, 12 years ago that there was this insane men's market for buying shoes. Brands, releases, special orders, you name it. And they found out that the more of these they create in a controlled fashion, the more they will have this type of male buyer buy, and at high prices too. Tennis shoes. Are any of you shoe collectors here? I mean, we used to see the typical female 18 to 30 had, what was it, like 48 pairs of shoes? Yes, that many. Now we're seeing a subculture of men who can have 300 to 400 pairs of shoes, ranging in value. The total collection can be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars over a collection lifetime. It's staggering. But anyway, that's a synergism right there. You keep producing a product in a controlled fashion, and they'll keep buying the new ones on the basis of already having a collection of, say, Adidas or these specialty Nikes or something like that. Okay, that's another one. And of course, now the problems that can come with doing incremental cash flow, there are other ones too. Of course, these are two heavies, but another nasty is, as I already mentioned, competition. The worst thing that can happen to you is being successful. Because if you are successful, you guarantee it, someone's going to come in and do a knockoff. And it might be a very large company that does a knockoff of your product. And they can just swamp you. A great small company can produce a product and get destroyed by a larger company. Technically, some of that is illegal as hell. Microsoft committed, you know, blatant crimes in the 1990s, taking out Netscape and several and WordPerfect by illegal methods. But it was so huge that it could just walk in, that's a popular product, we're just going to make our own version of it and wipe you out. The way that Gates and his gang of thugs did it was illegal, and they even admitted it in their in a decree, US v. Microsoft in the year 2000. But by that time, Microsoft was so large, there was nothing we could do about it. What are you going to do? Put Microsoft in jail? Anyway, competition is going to be something that you've got to watch out for and think about. And of course, some of the other things, and I'll just write this one down. Cost overruns. Cost overruns is just going to be an absolute pain in the ass. I mean, you hear the stories about cost overruns in government projects, and you're just shocked by this. Well, it happens in business too. You can have cost overruns that just knock you dead. You try your best to create contracts where this doesn't happen, but at the same time, if your supplier has jacked up the price 20%, what are you going to say? Right in the middle of a project, no, we're not going to buy it from you anymore. Well, where are you going to get it? They planned with you this whole time, and now you're going to cut them off, and their 20% was probably because their suppliers had done something to them to raise costs. Okay. Now, related to this, but I want to separate it out, and this is important, is regulatory regime change. The regime is the set of rules under which you are operating in the regulatory environments. Particular concern to us, aside from Occupational Safety and Health Administration, they are fairly consistent in their rules. Don't do things that kill your workers or injure them. But there is also the one that is the wild card is environmental regulation. Environmental regulation is fickle. It can be one way at one time, and then you've planned a 20-year project. By the end of that project, regulatory oversight regulations have changed, and you got no plan in your budget to deal with how you have to deal with the end of the project in terms of site remediation and all that kind of stuff. So that can be a big problem. Also, on the fly in a project, you can have a blind side. You've produced a project, a product, and then the government says, well, that doesn't meet our current standards. Well, when were those standards set? Well, just a few weeks ago. We've been planning this project for years, and you change it on us now after we built it? Are you out of your minds? That is a big, big problem. There's a company up in Chicagoland, Navistar. They were nearly destroyed financially by a change in regulations on the way that they were up doing the up armor on some military vehicles and all of that, and on the fuel efficiency standards. They'd already done the work, and then the regulations, they were told, don't worry about it, you're grandfathered, and then they weren't, and then the company nearly died because of that. In that same vein is also court decisions. A court can change the law as it is interpreted by the courts, and you didn't see it coming, and you've got a major, major problem on your hands. A recent example of this, whether it was right or wrong to do it is irrelevant. A court awarded an insanely large amount of money to plaintiffs who had said that glyphosate in other words, Roundup and pesticides that have glyphosates in them were cancer-causing. There had never been any evidence before it, despite many studies, but then this court ruled these people are awarded a huge amount of money because they are sick, and we have determined that that was because of the glyphosate that they were consuming. So now production of pesticides is under great challenge. The free cash flows, first of all, they're going to go down because of this decision, and second of all, and the payouts to the plaintiffs, and then second, over time, do we even produce this anymore? We were planning to produce this for another 15 years, and now if we are going to end up getting sued back to the Stone Age, we might have to end this project early and then spend money on R&D for something to replace it. That's what you guys are facing. You're business majors. People in arts and sciences, fine arts, nursing to some extent, they don't know about these. They don't see this part of the big picture of keeping the country producing and innovating technologically and all of that. What's coming up on the horizon as far as problems go in regulatory? Eventually, there will be litigation, probably in the mid-2020s, about the electromagnetic environment in which everyone is living now. We are living in an ocean of electromagnetism that has never happened in animal evolution, except for when a supernova would have popped off somewhere near us. So that may very well be found to cause certain types of cancers, mental illnesses, genetic defects, and all of that. If that's the case, then you're going to see the future expected cash flows from a whole lot of everything going down as litigation proceeds and there are lawsuits and awards of massive damages in the industries that create that electromagnetic ocean we're swimming in now. That's a big one that's coming up. Anyway, all of that positive news aside, yes, we still take on projects. We do it all the time. And then we do it in the best way possible. By the standards, interestingly enough, that professors like me teach you, our future business leaders, or something like that. And then if things go south and the project turns out to be a disaster or the regulatory environment changes, we don't have them pointing the finger at us, because we say we've proceeded by the best practices as they existed at the time we did the planning for this project. And so if it went wrong, well, guess what? That's how life works. In other words, CYA is everything. Get the numbers right, do it by the right methods, and then even if things go south on us, which they oftentimes do, well, we're covered, and we blame someone else, like the marketing people or human resources or the janitor or something. I don't know. Okay, look. First things first. Let's try a $10,000 project. This project is going to have a cash flow that will bleed us out $10,000 in year zero. Okay? Now, of course, these are simplistic, and I'll get a little more realistic. Matter of fact, if I do it right on Thursday, I can start to show you a couple of real-life projects that actually happened. Now, I'll simplify the numbers. I caution, I will simplify the numbers in them to some extent. But these are actually real projects that happened. And so we'll start with some basic numbers schemes. Zero, ten, and then here's one. In year one, we managed to pull off one of those one-hit wonders. Let's say that we have $5,000 in year one of revenue, and then we have positive $3,000 of revenue. Year three, we hold steady at about $3,000. Year four, we drop off the face of the earth to about $1,500. And year four, we're projecting that the free cash flow, now this is free cash flow, this isn't profit, this is free cash flow. Let's say that we manage to sell $500 worth of this stuff. Now here's where something comes in that's absolutely critical. And I'm coming back to things that I mentioned early in the course, but at this point, let's say that our salvage value is $300. Now, salvage value can be positive or negative. Your first problems in the homework will have no salvage value, which is ridiculous. Well, okay, there's positive. You can sell off equipment, or at least donate it and get a tax deduction for your donations to charities. I mean, computers are a great thing. A project where you have new computers, that those computers will be obsolete by year four, but so you're going to want to replace them every 4 years in a four-year cycle, let's say. But those old computers, you don't just throw those away. You could donate those to schools in low-income neighborhoods. You could donate them to old age homes. You could donate them to all kinds of places and get a tax deduction. On the other hand, you're also going to have deal with negative cash flows, negative numbers too. Remediation is always going to be a pain in the ass. You shut down a project, guarantee you there are going to be environmental remediation costs. You say, well, why? We didn't use anything toxic. Yes, you did. Well, for one thing, if you used anything that was electronic, you've got environmental waste. And it is regulated how you can dispose of it. So if you don't give those computers away to someone else, you're going to have someone take those away that has a responsibility for proper disposal of them, which means that, of course, either you remediate yourself or you have experts remediate, but in either case, you're going to have a problem with that waste out there. and I've mentioned this before, if you go down Veterans Parkway and turn on GE Road, there's a Walgreens there, and then there's on the one side you can go back to a Pier 1, and on the other side you go back to the Biagi's and the Giardino's Pizza. You'll see this massive abandoned factory, one-story building, just sitting there. And it has a for sale sign on it. You see, you know, the question would be, why didn't they just tear that down? Oh, yeah. Do you have any idea what the cost of environmental remediation on that thing is going to be? They don't want to deal with it. If they tear that down, asbestos is flying everywhere. They have to have experts who know how to bring down a building without having the asbestos go everywhere. It's just a nightmare of remediation. So yeah, in a case like that, you're probably going to be lucky if you can give away that building, because it's obsolete as far as technological compatibility goes. I mean, whoever owns it is going to have to tear it down if anything else is ever going to go there, but that's going to cost a lot of money. So there'd be a salvage value that's negative as hell. Another one that's a problem, of course, is if you are have any kind of a factory, you probably have some place in that factory where there is toxic waste, or there has been some place where toxic waste got into the soil at some time in the past. You're going to have to contain that, and that's going to be a cost. So salvage value can be positive, but don't be surprised if it's a negative number that makes your hind leg go up and down. Keep that in mind. So in this case, we've got a salvage value of $300. What do we do with that? We just add it to the end year. We just put that on the end year. That's all you do. Now, like I said, the first problems are going to be ones where there's a zero there, okay? They'll say no salvage value, or they won't even mention salvage value. But eventually, you do have to recognize, positive or negative, that salvage value, and you just put that on the last year's cash flow. And from there, it's actually, this is the hard part, is estimating the cash flows. And it's also, once you get the hang, it's just like putting together a puzzle, really. A complicated puzzle, but it's a puzzle. And once you get this part, this is actually kind of the fun part, projecting and having the reality checks on each other in your teams when you put these numbers out. I've got these numbers for our revenue, and having the ability to see the person who says, I got these revenue numbers, and you're the one who says, well, that's just the stupidest projection I've ever seen. You're never going to get that. Okay, now, anyway, we've got our projected cash flows through the end of the life of the project. And so now, from here, we need to know whether it's a go or a no-go. Yes or no. And that's what it comes down to in finance. Yes or no. So, what we would want to do is we need a discount rate for these future expected cash flows. And as I said, the discount rate that is often taught is the weighted average cost of capital. You figure out what your WACC is in the company and you use that to discount. That is absolutely ridiculous to do. It is wrong, but it's done. Far better would be to use the capital asset pricing model in some way to say the discount rate for this project is going to be the risk-free rate, which we can get from tables, plus the beta of the project times expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. Okay, wonderful. That's great. However, of course, finding the beta of the project is going to be the significant stop here. Because, I mean, if it's a project, you can't look up in a book of betas. You can't go on Yahoo Finance and say, okay, well, we've got this new jet airplane passenger airliner. Well, let's look up the beta of a passenger airliner. No, it's not going to work that way. What you would probably have to do, as I've said before, you'd find companies that are exclusively in that line of business and use that an average of those betas, or you would have to do some kind of an adjustment on a composite beta of companies that do this and other kinds of jetliners. One way or the other, CAPM is still your best bet. Is it used? Not that often. Is it the right way to go? Yeah. Otherwise, you're just feeling in the air, hoping. But anyway, enough of that. Let's say that we get a discount rate of 9.8%. Wonderful. Now, if you want to do it the hard way, I can do it the hard way here. I can take the present value 4 years out of 800 plus the present value of 1500 3 years out, etc. In other words, I can do negative $10,000 plus $5,000 times 1 plus 0.098 to the negative first power plus 3,000 times 1 plus 0.098 to the negative second power plus 1,500 times 1 plus 0.098 to the negative third power plus 800 times 1 plus 0.098 to the negative fourth power. Do that whole thing and see what your number is. If you really want to do it that way, yeah, that's old school. That was how we used to do it. Back before there were computers. Yes, there was a time before computers. It was about 6 million years of human evolution. But fortunately, now we have calculators that can do this a lot faster. Seriously? Okay. Apps. Finance. Go down to 7. NPV. We are calculating the net present value of future expected cash flows. Enter. Now it's going to come back to the main screen. NPV, open parenthesis. So what we do here is, first of all, we put in the discount rate, 9.8, comma. And then we put in the negative cash flow, negative $10,000, comma. Now, as I've said several times before, when we tell a TI that we've got a positive cash flow cluster coming, we actually open braces. That second parenthesis. Most, if you get an error, it's almost guaranteed that you got the error because you put a parenthesis either at the beginning or the end of the cash positive cash flow. Keep that in mind. Yeah, I do it too. It's just something that happens. Okay, so now we're going to put in, we're saying, here comes the positive free cash flow. 5,000, whoops, try that again. 5,000, comma, I can't even read my own stupid writing. 3,000, comma, 1,500, comma, 800, and then you say, all right, I am now very done with my positive cash flows. So I second close the brace. And now I close the parenthesis that opened the whole function. And I say enter. And it is negative $1,274. And so we reject the project. This is a negative net present value project, we reject. If it's positive, we accept. If it's negative, we reject. That's how simple it is at the end for us. All of the work, the planning of this project, the projection of the future expected cash flows, the excitement building, it comes down to some jerk like me in the finance division who just says no. But no. But well, we could bring back new numbers. No. Don't you even dream of bringing back new numbers and trying to fudge it so that we take on a project just because of dreams you had. In this case, it's a negative net present value project. That's the end of it. There is no other part. So in other words, at a discount rate of 9.8%, this is a negative NPV project. And we can do this, and of course, like I said, Excel can do this too. Just for some reason, I prefer the TI's way of doing it, because the Excel, it's sort of like there's no distinction between the negative and the positive free cash flows. Now, there's one remaining matter here. I'm going to do something here. I'm going to draw a vertical axis that's the net present value. And a horizontal axis that is the discount rate that I used. -100, -200, -500, -600, -800, -1000, -1200, -1300, -1400, -1500. That'll be as far as I go down. Now I'll go up 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10,000 positive 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'll do 1,500. Okay, so now on this axis, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5%, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10%. So at 9.8%, I came up with a negative $1,274. Negative $1,200 about there at negative 9.8%. Well, just as a matter of consideration, look, I know that if the discount rate had been lower, my net present value would have been better because I wouldn't have been discounting as heavily. So what if I were to have changed that? Let's say I tried 5% for my discount rate. There's an easy way to do this. I don't have to key in the whole thing again. You can just edit the original formula by just saying second, enter. And the original formula comes back up for editing. Now in this case, what I'm going to do is I'm going to say, what if I'd done 5.0%? It was still negative, but not as bad. So at 5%, it's negative $564. At 5%, it's negative $564. Approximately there. Okay, let's get really radical here. What if I tried 2%? Okay, so I'm going to go back up. I'm going to go second, enter. And I'm going to come back up here, and I'm going to do a 2.0%. Ooh, almost. It's negative $61. So if I had done 1%, second enter, and come back up here, 1.0. Oh, it's positive at 1%, $116. Right there. So in other words, this thing right here, this line that connects these, this is called an NPV profile. That's called the net present or an NPV profile. In other words, it's at lower and lower discount rates, the NPV becomes more and higher and higher, until at there's a discount rate where it crosses from no to yes. And it looks to me like that is at about 1.5%. We have a name for this right here. This place where it crosses from positive to negative is called the internal rate of return. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. Now, sir, I've said this three times. Do you think that's something that would be on a test? Yeah, you think? As a matter of fact, let me say it one more time. The internal rate of return is the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. I'll tell you, back in the day, we can do this in the blink of an eye now, but back in the day, we would make really high precision, you know, like engineering graphs on the grid paper, and then we could eyeball to see the internal rate of return. Pretty close. If you did it like a big graph and you did the mechanical pencil and the ruler and all of that. That's how we did it. Unless we really wanted to play around back and forth trying interest rates until we got exactly zero. Here we can do it now with a calculator. I'm going to just simply edit this formula. Now with the internal rate of return, I don't need the discount rate. That's going to be found for me. So I'm going to edit this formula. Second entry. Excuse me. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to go up there and I'm going to put the cursor on the NPV function. And then I'm going to go apps, finance, and number 8 is internal rate of return. Just hit enter. See how it overwrites it? Now don't forget, the IRR doesn't need an interest rate, so I'm going to delete that interest rate and its comma. And then the calculator is literally just going to run back and forth, until it gets as close to zero as it's supposed to, as it's told to. Okay, ready? Now we're just going to say enter. 1.65% was the internal, rounded to two decimal places. 1.65% was the internal rate of return. So in other words, any discount rate that I would use under 6.5%, I would have said yes. Any discount rate I would have used above 1.65%, I would have said no. The truth of the matter is, internal rate of NPV is classic and correct for project decision making. However, the internal rate of return can be used as a method of its own using the hurdle rate. It's actually not a good idea to do it, but it is more popular, the IRR method, than the NPV method. But even though the internal rate of return method can actually give you the wrong answer in certain circumstances. And that's what I have to cover in the next lecture, and how we can correct for that using MIRR, the modified internal rate of return. But that's all I have for you today. I thank you.